Welcome back to episode 210 of the Tall Boy Radio Podcast. And as we always say, who knows where it goes when the beer flows? Well, the first thing I will tell you today is do not adjust your speakers. It isn't our microphones either. There is a little bit of bass in a couple of our voices as man flu has hit the Tall Boy Radio studio. So I can only apologize for that. But he's back from Turkey and his teeth are all intact. Gazza, how are you doing?
Hey, you little cheeky fucker. I'm pretty good, thanks, pal. Yeah, everything's all good, although there was a little bit of infection in there. And just to clarify, I haven't been to Turkey and I haven't had a brand new set of teeth. So I just want to throw that out there. But yeah, looking forward to this. I have missed a couple of episodes, so always good to be back with the lads. And looking forward to this. And I'm not quite sure to where it's going to go, but no doubt there'll be a couple of left turns along the way. So yeah, I'm really, really looking forward to it.
Indeed, indeed. Dave, how are you doing?
I'm suffering a bit of the old man flu as well, but bearing up under the weight. And to be honest, Gaz, I genuinely thought you'd been to Turkey to have your teeth done. Even my brother messaged me to say, has Gaz really been to Turkey? I thought that was a bit odd. I didn't think your wife, being a GP, would have let you do that. But, you know, there we go.
Yeah, that wasn't going to happen. Just to clarify, I have had a couple of teeth out and I've got a couple of caps and bridges in, but... And I will be having a couple of implants, but not a full set of turkey teeth. So there we go. Let's just clarify that. Get it out there. Cool singing. What the hell is going on here? Didn't sign up to this.
Loving it.
That's what we do on this podcast.
5 minutes in, all we've done is talk about his teeth. I'm going to introduce our guest tonight as a friend of mine I've known for a little while. It's a guy I really look up to. And, you know, he's got a really interesting history and journey he's been on, particularly in the last 7 or 8 years. So I'm going to let him introduce himself and tell us a little bit about himself. Cole Lehane, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thanks very much. Thanks, gents. I mean, I literally have not stopped laughing since I've joined this. So I'm looking forward to some great banter. And you know what? Sometimes you just can't beat some of that dad humor as well. Thanks very much for having me on here. In terms of who I am, where I've been, I guess my starting point would be that I spent 32 years in the police service in Derbyshire, rising up to the rank of temporary chief superintendent. You can probably see all my stuff up here. Somebody saw my handcuffs the other day and thought I was just being kinky until they saw the truncheon. And then they thought I was really kinky until they saw the medals and then realised what it was all about. So I left the police service some 9 years ago now, and my passion has really always been about people and leadership and how to get the best out of people. So that's what I've been doing over the last 9 years. On top of that, I had this thing in my mind that I wanted to create positive ripple effects across the country. So I created a motivational event. I was fed up of seeing Americans coming into the country and having all these motivational events. And I thought, hey, why can't we do it? We've got enough talent in the UK to do it. So I started an event off called Ignite Your Potential, with on the first one, barely 70 people turned up to it. And then my last one was in 2020, just before lockdown, we had 350 people. It's crazy. It's high energy. It's a wonderful event, but we've not been running any of those since 2020. It might come back because my work around leadership just exploded in 2020, which is a sort of a weird thing to happen, really, I thought at the time, because I was stuck at home just like anybody else. I did my office up. That's why it looks so decent behind me. My wife's done all of that. And, you know, I found out that in organizations, people were suffering. There was a need for emotional resilience. So I qualified in emotional intelligence. And now what I do with organizations is I help leadership coaching, but also to develop cultures where people feel safe, valued, appreciated, heard, and also a bit of humor in organizations, which I think is a really good thing to have.
There's a ton of stuff there, Cole. When you first joined the police force, it was... you were pretty rare, weren't you? Just tell us when you joined and how you stood out at that time.
Yeah, I mean, my dream to be a police officer goes right back to like 10 years old. I was born and bred in Wolverhampton and I was one of seven. There was nine of us living in a 2.5-bedroom terraced house in the middle of Wolverhampton, the concrete jungle. And, you know, my dad used to sit us down. Have you ever watched that film, East is East?
Yeah.
right? Yeah. So that was my dad. That was my dad. So my dad used to, we had like two rooms downstairs. We had the front room and we had the back room. So the back room was where everybody sat. The front room, nobody was allowed to sit in there at all because that was for like guests. We never had guests, you know, but that was like the room for guests. It was immaculate. But on a Sunday, we were allowed to sit. Well, we were made to sit on this big settee, all seven of us. And my dad would put on his Sunday best. He'd put on a shirt, a tie, and a suit. And he'd strode up and down and, you know, like he was like, you know, the motivational speaker. And he'd say, I want you to all be doctors. And if you can't be a doctor, be a dentist. And if you can't be a bloody dentist, at least be a lawyer. So like, all my brothers and sisters used to be like nodding their heads vigorously. So it's no surprise, really, that I've got my two elder brothers are doctors. My eldest brother got a bit carried away. He's a doctor and a lawyer. My sisters became nurses, and I was like the odd one out because all I wanted to do was be a cop. Now, we lived like two streets away from the mecca that is Molyneux Stadium. You know, the Adams is shaking his head away. But I used to sit on this corner of a wall two streets away from Molyneux Stadium watching these like thousands of fans going towards the stadium. And it was in Wolverhampton, sort of, how, you know, beautiful golden era where we were winning stuff. But it wasn't the fans I was looking at, but it was these big tall cops, you know, with the big helmets on and the tunics on. And they looked so smart, and everything that they represented was what I wanted to be. And I remember I used to go to this local police station. I used to ask for brochures on anything like police dogs, cadets, traffic cops, everything. And they literally got to a point where they just couldn't show me anything else. So that was where my infatuation started with the police service. And when I got to the age of 15 and a half, in those days, you used to have full-time police cadets. We were paid a handsome sum of £50 a month. And I remember I applied to like every single one of the 43 police forces up and down in the country. I think I even applied to a couple of Scottish ones, and I got rejected 26 times. So I said to my dad, well, there's no point. I may as well go to A-level. So I started doing A-levels, and then suddenly my dad saw this advert on TV for Derbyshire Police, and they were looking for cadets. Specifically, they were trying to do some positive action around BAME. So my dad said, look, just go one more time. Just try one more time. And I did, and I got through. And therein lies the start of my journey with policing. And when I turned up to my first police station, I realized that I was literally a brown speck in a sea of white. So it was a major culture shock for me, a major culture shock for my colleagues. But I tell you what, the communities that I policed, because back in those days, we had real proper beat bobbies, you know. I had my own area. I knew to check every single door handle of the town centre properties. I knew where to get warm at 4 o'clock in the morning, who'd be up. I used to get all the community intelligence. I used to know who lived where. I could knock on somebody's door and say, I need to arrest you for assault last night, but I'm going to let you come to the police station of your own accord. And people would turn up, all this kind of stuff. It was great. As I got more and more senior in the service, I started to realize there was politics at play, and all of them, try and navigate yourself through the politics of any organization is hard. And trying to navigate yourself through in that era where there was some kind of biases that exist, that was even harder. But I committed to, you know, there's two ways you can respond to that. One is to get really angry and start taking people to court. And I've seen that happen. I just don't think that works for anybody. Everyone sort of, nobody really succeeds from that. But the other way is to get yourself in a position where you can influence the culture, which is the pathway that I took. So every department I ever went into, I used to try and shape that department, influence that department so that everyone wanted to work to their fullest degree. And I guess that's where my infatuation with leadership really came in, recognizing that you can turn people around just by how you treat them. It's so, so very important. And I think, you know, after COVID and everything else, I think more and more organizations need to do that with their people, because people are unhappy, generally speaking. We've had the highest levels, if you think about it, the highest levels of people leaving organizations in history, something called the Great Resignation. we've got more and more people doing what they call quiet quitting now. And this wasn't even a term a few years ago, quiet quitting, where people work to the minimum standards. And now we've had unprecedented industrial action across all sectors. And I hear just this morning that the looks like the, you know, the railway workers are going to go on strike yet again. We had consultants, for goodness sakes, going on strike. So something's not right. And I know that everyone says it's all about pay, but I think it's more than just pay. It's pay and conditions. And the conditions part of it, I think, is very, very important. I think people genuinely want to come to work to feel appreciated. I'm a big believer that most people want to do a good, honest day's work for a good, honest wage. And people want to work. I don't think people are genuinely lazy. I think people can be made to seem to be lazy just because they're unhappy where they are. So that's sort of what drives me. Every single morning I get up and I think, right, how can I influence one person to just have that better life at work? That's it. That's what keeps me going every single day. And on top of that, as I had this passion for speaking about this area, I suppose I got sucked up into being asked to talk about it on a regular basis. So I'm a natural introvert, but I found myself on stages in front of thousands of people talking about this. I've been on TV. I've accidentally created TV dramas. I've just done some crazy stuff, and I don't know how or why it's happened. And because I've done a lot of speaking, I actually created a public speaking program, which we won an award for last year as being the best public speaker trainer of the year. And I genuinely don't know how all of this happens, but I have a philosophy in my life. And as I get older, I make sure this philosophy works harder. That just say yes to every single opportunity that comes your way and worry about it afterwards, because I'm a big worrier. I overanalyze everything. I will wake up in the middle of the night and think, oh my God, that thing I said yes to, will it work? So I just say yes. Think about it afterwards. If it works, it works. If it doesn't, it doesn't. But at least you won't have regret.
Well, that's why you're here, Cole, tonight.
Absolutely. This is way past my bedtime.
I got a really important question. A little while ago, you talked about Wolverhampton Wanderers and their golden era. Which month was that?
Yeah. Can you remember 1978? We won the, what was it called then? Was it the League Cup? It was the League Cup. Yeah, I think we beat
the Rumbelows or League
Rumbelows Cup. Yeah.
Yeah.
We beat Andy Gray, scored the winning goal against Nottingham Forest. I remember it like it was yesterday, because that's the only thing I'm going to remember about Wolves.
I was about to say the only golden thing about Wolves has been the colour of their kit.
Oh, yeah. We had some awesome players, though, back in the day.
Yeah, he did. I remember the likes of Steve Ball, you know what I mean? So some decent players.
That was even before his era, though.
Oh, wow. Wow. Yeah. I've got a question for you there. How would you accidentally create a TV drama?
Well, here's the thing. I mean, this is stupid, really. I mean, have you watched that drama, that Line of Duty?
Yeah.
I've not watched it, but I've seen it.
Yeah.
Right. So Line of Duty, my wife and I was watching it. And of course, I don't know what jobs you guys have done, but if you saw a program about your job that you've been doing for years and years and years, you're going to analyze it, aren't you? You're going to criticize it. And Line of Duty is so far removed from like reality that I was like screaming at the TV. But then by the second, but on the other hand, I also loved it. I thought, what a brilliant drama this is. This is like incredible. And I got chatting to somebody. I just happened to be at somebody's house, and there was a chap there who happened to be a script writer. And I said, do you know what? I love that Line of Duty, and I love police dramas. I really would like to create a police drama of my own, and I would like to have this. And I had all these like ideas, and I said, I'd love to do this, and I'd love to do that. So we got chatting over the time. A couple of years later, I paid it no more heed. A couple of years later, I set up a social enterprise, and it was called Tri Potential. And really the idea about this enterprise was that I didn't realize this, but I know it now that in the British Army and the military, they have Commonwealth citizens that come and join the British military, and they'll stay there for X number of years, and they will put them into operational arenas. And then after 6 or 7 years, whenever they want to go, then they have to apply for citizenship. And I thought, well, that can't be right, because, you know, these people have put their lives at risk for the country. They should automatically become British citizens. And actually, aren't we losing all this talent? Because military people make for great cops because they have the discipline. It's a very similar mindset, et cetera, et cetera. So I created this social enterprise with another chap, and the idea was that we would take people who were leaving the army and the military, who were Commonwealth citizens, and bring them either into the police service or into things like the fire service. Nothing much happened with that, but we tried to get it moving. But this scriptwriter saw what I was doing, and he reached out and he said, "I think we've got our drama." I said, "What do you mean?" He says, "How about having a drama where we've got a West Indian guy who has been in the army, has some traumatic experience in the army, and then we bring him out of the army and he joins a police service and he becomes one of these like gung-ho cops. And then we put him in some bizarre place in the country. He thinks he's going to go to London, but he ends up in, like, I don't know. He says, somewhere in Scotland. I says, how about Aberdeen? Like, that's the one place in Scotland I've never been. He says, yeah, that's brilliant. So we just have this conversation. 6 months down the line, he rings me up. He says, guess what? He says, BBC Scotland are really interested in this drama that we've created. So they'd taken this idea that we'd had. They rewrote it, you know, the production company played with it, and they've done a great job with it. And actually, it's into season two now. And I met one of the actors from the drama only last year, and she's a great person. And she was saying how much she loved being on there. And it's now on BBC iPlayer. So it's called Granite Harbour. And if you sort of look at it from, watch it from the very start, I think the second slide in, is it says created by Culmer Hay, or based on an idea by Culmer Hay and Adriel Yeff.
That's fantastic.
Now, I never thought I'd ever see my name on anything like that ever. I've sort of got a bit of a bug for it now. So we've written a couple of dramas ourselves now that we're trying to pitch out to BBC, ITV, or whoever else that might want to have a police drama.
Wow. That's impressive, dude. That's really impressive. Why not?
Yeah, that's an incredible story. Yeah, brilliant.
I just think that you've got to do these things. You just never know. If you say yes to everything, you just never know where it's going to end up being. You know. So, for example, this human-centered leadership, that started with, I thought, you know, emotional intelligence, yeah, it's what I do. It's what I'm really, really passionate about. And I do it at a very deep level, whereas most people just do it very superficial. And I thought, yeah, but you know what? If I keep saying emotional intelligence to organization, they're going to get bored of it because everyone's heard of emotional intelligence and they think, oh, it's just another. So let's give it a name. So I created human-centered leadership, which essentially I think is what it's all about. So I created like this podcast, which really was on the spur of the moment, if I'm honest. It was on the spur of the moment. And I created this podcast and I've had some incredible people on this podcast, you know, people that I would never think would say yes to any of this, you know, like international people, multi millionaires, and you know, top governmental people and top army people. It's just incredible. That's been going 2 years. So I decided that with this podcast, I was going to now create a brand. So there's a whole brand coming after this. There's like the Human Centered Leadership Conference, which we'll talk about. And there's a program that I'm creating, which has grown from this idea that I had, which is going to be at like master's level. So people come on the program, they get like this level 7 qualifications in human-centered leadership. So they can say quite proudly, I'm a leader. And then we're going to do like a leadership retreat for stressed out senior leaders. And it just makes sense. And it all came with me saying yes to something. That's all it is, you know? Wow. So that's why I say yes to everything. Having said all of that, I failed many, many times as well. I really have. I've made some big boobies.
But it's okay to fail, though. And that's it. You know, I'm an education, so I'd say, you know, to the kids, it's actually okay to fail. We use a little acronym, and we always say that fail, if you fail, it's your first attempt in learning, and that's what we use. We use the acronym of FAIL, and it's your first attempt in learning. And actually, if you continue to make the same mistakes over and over again, then you're not learning, obviously. But actually, it's okay, because failing actually builds resilience, and you need that resilience inside you to keep going and to keep doing the things that you want to do. So
yeah,
we use that a lot. And it's just listening to you there, you know, just talking about it. And myself and the executive head at the school that I work at, you know, we talk very much about, you always try to you sort of on the way up, you meet people and try to network, and you always put yourself out there, because actually on the way up, if you do that, you never really know when you're coming back down, you might need a favor, you might bump into them again, you know, so it's always about that networking. And some things happen by happen chance, some things happen because you plan it, but you can never really plan for everything. So there are things that just spontaneously happen. And the story about you and the script writer, it's like, gee, you didn't plan that, you didn't think it was going to happen, but it did. And then fantastic things have happened on the back of that. So it's just fascinating just to listen to talk just about sort of leadership and your vision of what leadership is and how you can help to shape leadership and teams of leadership and so on. And I'd be fascinated perhaps after this podcast just to sort of get your details and just have a chat at some point just about what it is you can do. Because our leadership team at school, you know, we're always looking at ways of sort of working with our staff just to make sure that they feel as though they've been listened to, they feel as though that there's a reason to come to work, so on and so on. So certainly after the podcast, Dave, you send some details and we'll definitely get in touch.
Oh, I mean, I'd love to do that. And here's the thing, another example of when you start saying yes to things, or when you just sort of accept the process. I think we're all of a similar age. I'm probably a bit older than you guys, but I've just got to that age in my life where I think wisdom is beginning to kick in and I'm not fazed by many things. I just go with the flow now and I want to do what I want to do. And by doing that, as much as I'm one of the worst self-critics I know, and I genuinely am, I put a post up on LinkedIn about it. I beat myself up all the time, but I've also got relaxed with it as well. I know I'm going to beat myself up, so I just accept it. You know what? You're going to talk some nonsense to yourself, but other people say nice things, so I just listen to what other people say. And by doing that, I've been asked by universities to write programs, design leadership development programs for universities. I've even got to a point where I designed one program for University of Lincoln, which was such a success. And it was really around how do we get underrepresented leaders aspiring and building skill sets to become senior leaders? And the university wanted to do all the right things. And they were really frustrated that they weren't getting enough people coming up to senior levels. So I designed a 3-month program, which we've run with about 3 or 4 cohorts now at the university. And then the schools of psychology from 2 universities, Lincoln and Nottingham, approached me and says, hey, we could do with a similar program because we have this thing. There's an underrepresentation of the people that come from postgrad psychology up to the doctoral program. And we've got a disparity there. They said, could you design a program? I said, why did we redesign it? This program should work. And you know what? We are now on cohort 5, and that's me. And I still pinch myself when I'm doing this. That's me essentially teaching psychology to psychologists. And it works. And we've had this increase. We've had this success. We've had this increase in the number of people getting up to being successful at the doctoral program. And there's nothing better for me than when I get emails or messages or WhatsApps from people saying, called just to let you know, I've now been headhunted by this university as a professor, or I've just done this, or I've got to director level in this organization, and I applied what you taught me either on your public speaking program or in one of my leadership programs, and I've applied that, and this has got me there. And I just think, so I am doing something. I must be doing something right. And that's what keeps me going. Yes.
Yeah.
It matters not to me whether this is like teaching 40, 50-year-olds or teaching 14, 15-year-olds. The concept is exactly the same.
Yeah, I'm just as a sort of, you know, real recent example, we were on this Create and Speak course at the weekend, and there's a guy on there called Patrick, and it was the happiest bus driver in Birmingham, was it?
London.
Yeah. At one point. And he had some difficulties. His mum died. He had to go back to Nigeria, backward and forward. And he'd been homeless. He's got this wealth of sort of stories, and invited into the podcast. He will come on the podcast, but he was basically,
get ready for that, guys.
He was. We have these wristbands from Ignite Your Inner Potential. So do it now, and that's what you know. What colors? You know, do it now, do it now. And Patrick had all of this, and every time we kept saying to him, "Why are you not doing it?" He said, I don't know. I'm just not doing it. He's been on this course, and he's posted in the WhatsApp group tonight that he's got a little speaking gig. It's not a paid gig, but it's a speaking gig, and it's just taken that from Cole's course at the weekend. This guy, he's lovely, got so much to offer, but just wasn't doing it, and he's had that instilled in him that you just got to do it.
Yeah,
and he's just posted already that he's got a little speaking gig. It's just awesome to see.
Patrick is an incredible guy, but his learning style was so unique that I was getting really frustrated on day one. I'm thinking, I'm not getting through to Patrick. He's not getting what I'm teaching. And I remember it was playing on my mind so much, I came home. My wife's a teacher. She works in a pupil referral unit. So she works with SEN children, those with behavioral challenges and all this kind of stuff. And I was saying, I don't think I'm getting through to Patrick. I don't know what I need to do. And she said, well, maybe he's just got a different learning style. Maybe you need to present it to him in a visual format. So the next morning I said to Patrick, I'm going to come in early and me and you will have spent some time. So I actually drew his talk out visually on a flip chart, and suddenly you saw the light bulb switch on. And when he got up on the stage, David, wasn't he amazing?
Yeah. I mean,
what were you moaning about? You just done an amazing talk on the stage, and you had me in somersaults yesterday. You know, it was this for me. Yeah. And I love it when that happens.
Yeah, it was, I mean, for there was, what, seven of us on this course, and we were all watching Patrick go through the motions, and at sometimes he was so panicked,
yeah.
and nothing would go in his head. And one of the things that Cole teaches us as a sort of basic sort of blueprint of how you do your talks is where you position yourself on the stage and how you transition through the stage to do different bits of talk. And Patrick just could not get that in his head. And that's when Taj, Cole's wife, suggested something different. And even when Patrick said he got it, 30 seconds later he said, I haven't
gone, it went again.
And then when it was his turn to speak, he just got up there and he just moved around that stage like he knew exactly. And we're all sitting there going, this is a different guy. And it's things like that. And that's why, you know, what Cole does, and you know, Cole, it's about the passion, and it's about, you know, making change. You know, Cole said more than once, it's not about the money. You know, he does things that he's passionate about, that he's interested in, that's going to make a difference. And just that one change in Patrick makes your weekend. Just from that, never mind all the other people, myself included, that went through this sort of transformation. It's awesome stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I love it. I still pinch myself that when people turn up on a Saturday morning telling me I can't speak on a stage, they see the stage and they start getting into a panic. And I always have this confidence that in 24 hours time, you will be on that stage delivering a talk. But then I always have these doubts that kick in as well. And with Patrick, the doubts are there, like magnified. But when it was all over, like by midday on the Sunday, I was like, wow, we did it again. How does that happen? You know, I've designed this, but I'm still asking myself, how did that happen? You know, so I've got a lot of faith in people, in human beings. The capacity to learn at any age is just incredible. So I think that we should never stop learning. We should always be growing. As leaders, as human beings, we should always be growing.
I think we'd all like to hear a little bit of the feedback you had for Dave.
Well, my wife says that Dave should actually be on Audible, or he could be doing one of those like sexy voiceovers. She's in love with his voice.
Oh my word.
Wow. You weren't expecting that one, were you, Adam?
No. If you said hearing aid adverts, then maybe.
You know what? You might just see him on like voicing over like a hemorrhoids advert or something like that. I love it.
Yeah. You spent a weekend with Dave, I can tell.
Thanks for that. Appreciate it, all of you. Thanks.
Pleasure. So I'd be interested then. So in terms of that, then obviously you sort of said you've got that belief, and by the end of the weekend you think you're going to have everybody do it. But there's always that element of self-doubt in the back of your mind. Always. Not self-doubt, but doubt. You know, will we be able to?
It's always there, Adam. It's always there. It's like my nemesis. And you know, I sleep well. You know, I'll zonk out at 10 o'clock and I'll wake up about 6 o'clock. I get my 8 hours sleep. I'm grateful for that because, you know, in 32 years of policing, I was almost constantly on call. I'd be woken up like 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning to make life and death decisions because I was a gold commander. And I had to make these like incredibly powerful and important decisions, like literally 4 or 5 minutes after I've woken up. So now I'm so grateful for the sleep that I get. But that self-doubt often is the thing that wakes me up. So if I'm doing something really exciting or if I've got a new project on, like, you know, we've got this human-centered leadership conference in March and it's big. It's huge. There's going to be 300 or 400 people there. It is groundbreaking because nobody else is talking about what we're going to be talking about. I've got some top leaders there. I've got people at the very top end of the army coming. I've got top people from the policing industry. I've got people who are like leading governmental organizations, chair of the Youth and Crime Panel. From the government. So I've got all sorts of people coming to this and everything's going right. But the self-doubt keeps telling me something's not right yet. Something's not right yet. It's not done yet. So I've just got comfortable with this nemesis in my head. I know that whenever I do something big or new or something that's impacting on somebody's life, that's part of the responsibility that I have. And I have to take that responsibility seriously. And I guess the bigger the responsibility, the more that self-doubt creeps in. I don't think there's a magic button.
You look at self-doubt and you look at sort of imposter syndrome and all of that. The higher you go and the more you start to mix with peers of a similar level, you sort of look around and when you go to sort of leadership conferences or head conferences and that sort of stuff, you look around and think, like, wow, like, look at that guy. He's got that loads of experience. Or look at that guy.
Yeah.
And you measure yourself up and as much as you might sit there, because, you know, I get it terribly, sort of imposter syndrome, but then you talk to the next guy and they say that they get it. And then they look at me and go, well, wow, look at the experience he's got. So everybody has it.
Absolutely.
And it's just, I suppose it's just how you deal with that. And it's frightening. It's scary when you're asked to either present or to speak or to deliver in front of the people that you feel as though you've got imposter syndrome because it's scary. It's hard.
I think it's a bigger issue and it's a more important issue than we give it credit for as well, because actually it sort of, if we can just talk serious for a moment, I think it actually impacts on mental health as well of leaders. And, you know, I get to now work with executive teams in organizations and I start talking to them and they start telling me about some of their pressures and their self-doubt and their, you know, their loneliness in leadership, because sometimes leadership can be an extremely lonely position. And that's when you start reflecting that, you know, this negative language that goes on inside your head that you literally have got no one else to turn to, you think. So consequently, you have this battle that goes on in your head, and that can actually lead to very, very poor mental health. And, you know, over the last few months, I've been aware of at least two senior leaders who have taken their own lives. We don't know what their individual circumstances were, but there's something there, I think. And I just don't think that we talk about mental health a lot, don't we? But we seem to talk about it when we talk about it at a much lower level. We don't talk about it at the executive level, at that senior leadership level, because it's there. We're only human beings at the end of the day.
Yeah, I think one of the things when you talk about mental health, it always seems to be a diagnosis of or an understanding of. What we don't really do is understand how the factors impact, you know, me, you, everybody, and how we interpret that and how we deal with it and the effect it has on us. However, while we are talking about something that is quite serious, we have a very serious question here from Albert. David, if you wanted to read that one out.
Albert Cull is my son.
All right, okay.
I'm going to assume his typos are a joke. I have to do a speech next Monday in front of English. My English class. Yeah, I think he's missed the G out on purpose. Teacher, for his whole class and the teacher, they're recording it. And have you got any top tips for him?
I'm going to give you a couple of top tips there, Albert. One, think about three things that you actually want them to take away from your talk. So what would be the three things for you? And secondly, before you tell them the three things, tell them a story that is related to the three things that you want them to teach. So think of a story in your head, in your life, maybe in the life of somebody else. Think of a story that will show the three things that you're going to talk about. So, for example, you might say, So the other day I was doing this and this happened and then this happened and then this happened. So what I learned from that are these three things that I want to share with you today. So if you just did it like that and then tell them the three things, I think your talk will come out looking a lot more sort of confident and authoritative.
Tell you what, Cole, I'm going to test you because Cole does a lot of this over the weekend. In fact, before we come on to this, Albert, Cole says at one point, like, give me any subject and I'll just talk about it.
Outrageous, that was.
And Taj, Cole's wife, is shouting over, David, say women's knickers. Say women's knickers. I dare
was
you.
It her
I dare
idea?
You.
Was it her idea?
Taj, yeah, did you not know?
No.
So Cole had to talk for 5 minutes about spontaneously about women's knickers. But he did it. And so what I was going to say, Cole, is that Albert's speech is on why it's important to play an instrument and why the piano is the best one. So just give us 60 seconds on that, Cole, to give Albert an idea.
So the other day I was walking through St. Pancras Station, and I don't know if you know, but in St. Pancras Station, there's this beautiful piano and people just jump on it randomly and start playing. And I don't know about you, but railway stations can be very busy, very loud, very sort of, nobody really smiles at you. But suddenly I was drawn to this music. And as I'm walking through St. Pancras Station, I saw this beautiful piano and this young girl was playing on this piano. And it just made me realize, you know, music can really brighten our lives up. They can make our day feel so very special. And there is nothing better than the sound of the tinkling keys on a piano. So what I want to talk to you today about is the piano. Firstly, why music is so important in our lives. And secondly, why I think the piano is the best instrument. There you go.
Look at that. There you go, Albert.
There you go.
You can just make a story up, Albert. It's as simple as that.
Yeah, and don't talk about women's knickers, for crying out loud.
You've planted that idea in his head now. Yeah. He'll have a panic attack and say, my mom.
Yeah. Or playing with your organs. Sorry, David.
And there it is. It's only took us 39 minutes.
It's absolutely disgraceful, the pair of you, I tell you.
I apologise. There's something I read then on your website. I forget where it was now, but I can see it in my notes, and I'm just a little bit too far away, and I don't have my glasses with me. So only compete with who you were yesterday. Do you want to tell us about that?
And thanks very much for bringing that, Adam, because this is something I'm really, really passionate about. If we think about from the moment that we're able to understand or communicate, we're taught, literally taught all the time to compete. You have to be better than your siblings. You have to be a good boy or a good girl, and that means whatever it means. You go to school and then you're competing when you take your tests and your exams. You go to university and then you have to get to a certain university, you have to compete with everybody else to get a certain grade, limited numbers, therefore you are competing. You get to work and then you're competing to get a job, and then you compete to get promotion, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We live this constant life of competition. And I don't know about you guys, but the older I get, and I've done all of that, I've competed and the stresses have come with that. But the older I get, the more I realize it's not about competing with other people at all. You know, in my business, I literally do not look to see what other leadership specialists, culture change, transformation people are doing. I just do my thing. So I stay in my lane. The only way I know I'm going to be better is to look at the person I was yesterday and say, can I improve every single day just by 1 degree, by 1 centimeter, by 1 millimeter? So long as I'm not worse than I was yesterday, I'm okay with that. I have to be growing. And I have this saying that if you're not growing, you're dying, you know, and it is as simple as that. So growth, there's a great book on this called The Infinite Mind by a guy called Simon Sinek. And he talks about, you know, the finite mind is the mind that's constantly looking for that winning post. So you strive throughout your entire life and say, I need to get to this point. I need to get to this point. But then what happens when you get to this point? Then what? And that's when a lot of people sort of fall off the cliff. So for example, in the police service, there were a lot of people that said, I've just got to get my 30 years in, got to get my 30 years in, and then I'm going to retire. And they do, they retire. And then what happens? A lot of them get really old because they become old people because they don't do anything else. And for me, I'm not going to be that person because I want to be constantly striving forward and keep that mental agility alive and keep my body busy. And that the only way I'm going to do that is by constant growth. So the infinite mind doesn't have this winning pose. The infinite mind says, I just want to keep growing every single day. I want to enjoy the journey, but I know that I'm going generally, I know the direction I'm heading, but I'm just going to keep going forward. And that's it.
I think from a, and that's fascinating because from a sporting world, obviously Sir Dave Brailsford, who was the sort of key driver, I suppose, behind the success of the Sky Cycling team. And he
did an amazing job. Yeah,
and obviously he's now associated with the new investor Man United and the Ineos group and all of that. And he talks about marginal gains, and he was talking about the marginal gains. And it's he when he listened to him, he's a fascinating person to listen to. And he talks about exactly that, Paul, about that marginal gain, that if you can look for that one thing and you keep striving, and then when you add up all of those things, then you get to even just 1% better than somebody else. And he used it from a competitive point of view. But when you extrapolate the concept out, and they were constantly striving to be better than they were the previous day, and they were always looking for those marginal gains. Yeah. From a sporting competitive point of view, but when you think about how you can think about that in real life, you think actually look at yourself. Can I be better than the person I was yesterday? Yeah. And then can I strive to then be better tomorrow? And if you take that in, it's that type of mindset, isn't it? It's those marginal things that you can do just to be that incrementally tiny little bit better each day, and then over a period of time, you look back in over 12 months, you think, wow. Look at the change that we've affected over the last 12 months just by those tiny, tiny, tiny little incremental marginal gains over a short period of time.
I think that's a really important point because sometimes, you know, when you're just moving all the time and you think, oh, nothing's happening. But it's not until you put a foot on the ball and look back and say, look, I've just traveled all that distance because I'm not the person I was 3 months ago. I'm a totally different person. You're sort of regenerating, like the cells in your body are constantly regenerating. You're regenerating yourself by doing this. And another way that I've heard it explained is through compound interest. So, you know, we know that in finance, they talk about compound. So when you're compounding, you're reinvesting, and eventually you make a whole load of money, apparently. But it takes about 30, 40 years. But it's the same thing with your growth. You reinvest your learning. We keep reinvesting your learning. And eventually, you know, you'll have a significant growth without realizing it.
It's incredibly important because some people are so long-sighted and far-sighted that they don't really see the important bits that are right in front of them. But it's also equally then important to look back and reflect because of that reason, Cole. So you look back at because you don't realize the journey that you're on until, as you said, you know, you put your foot on the ball and you turn around and you have a look, because actually you're so used to doing that on that just sort of treadmill of work and so on, and you think, why am I doing it? But if you actually just stop and take a minute and reflect on the things that you have done, then put that into context about where you are now, and then think, okay, and to coin your phrase, how can I be better tomorrow than I am today? And you keep doing that. But I do think it's really important to reflect on what you have done in your past experiences to see how far you have come.
I think it's very important to stop every now and then and just to look back, you know, just look in your rearview mirror. I'll tell you another thing that I have in my mind that I practice an awful lot. If you only focus about what's going to happen next week or the week after, it's a bit like driving your car. So when I was a police officer, I went on a police advanced driving course. So basically what they teach you on a police advanced driving course is that you drive a car as fast as you possibly can, but as safe as you can all the time. And I remember on my police advanced driving course, I got up to 149 miles per hour. I was absolutely petrified on the M1, traveling at 149 miles an hour in the middle of January. But I tell you what, I was probably the safest person on the road just because of the awareness that I had that you learn on the course. And one of the key things that they taught us was never look where normal drivers look. Normally, drivers will be looking at the road about 10 meters to 20 meters in front of them. Good drivers, however, lift their eyes up and they look at the horizon where the road meets the horizon. And when you do that, what you find is A, you stay in the lane, and B, your whole journey smooths out. Your driving smooths out, your braking smooths out, your steering smooths out. So, I mean, try it. And I know it works because I this is how I drive my car. And life is just like that. If you look to say, if you get stressed about what's going to happen next week or next month, and don't think about the long term, this is the direction I'm heading, actually your life might feel a bit jittery, you know, and you will put yourself under some stress. But stop off at a service station every now and then, and then yeah. Reflect back and say, hey, I've just come all that way. You know, I've just achieved so much. It's the same analogy. You probably guess I love analogies. But is that? It just makes sense when you think about it.
So, Cole, were you gutted not to get to 150?
Yeah, I was a bit. If I'm honest, I was a bit. But I'll tell you what. When I looked at that speedometer and I quickly saw 149, I actually took my foot off the pedal and slowed down, and I got told off.
Listen, I'll give it a go tomorrow. I'll see if I can do 150 down the road.
You know what? I'm lucky if I get over 75 nowadays.
Oh, no, trust me, you won't get a Nissan Juke diesel at that speed. I can promise you that much. Just going back there a little bit to those incremental gains and tying it in with mental health and positivity, is that part of it? You know, when you're making those applications, and it's not just your work. I think your life in general is every bit as important.
Yeah,
as, you know,
no, there
is, you'll see that on various Instagram posts where it'll say the only, 20 years from now, the only people who remember you doing overtime are your kids and stuff like that is really important. I think if you make that application to yourself, that's really important. Can I ask, is spirituality, is that something that's important to you?
Yeah, it is very much so. I don't talk about it much, but spirituality, and I say spirituality rather than religion, spirituality is very important for me because it's hard to explain because it makes sense here, but then trying to say it this way, it's quite difficult. And the way that I see it is that I am not as big as I perhaps think I am. My ego might tell me I'm something quite special, but when you look at the earth, I am literally not even a pinprick on that earth. So there is something bigger than me, whether you call it a universal energy, whether you're into God and you say it's God that's doing this, some omnipotent being, or whether you think of the universe as a state of energy and that we're, when you look at the back of your hands with a microscope powerful enough, you'll find that we're all just made up of molecules that are bumping against each other through this friction of energy. So if that energy is within me, that energy is a part of the energy that exists around us and exists in the universe. So we could look at this in like a scientific quantum physics kind of way or in a religious spiritual kind of, but actually for me, it sort of means the same thing. And even our thoughts emit energy, our moods emit energy, and then they affect energy in other people. One of the great books that I once read was The Celestine Prophecy. It's been around a long, long time. If you've never read The Celestine Prophecy, I absolutely recommend that you do it. And it talks, and it's a fictional story, but it talks about this guy who's on some quest to find some scrolls in the world, some lost scrolls about spirituality. And he's embarked on this journey, goes to all these other countries. And then he starts meeting these people who can see energy around any living thing, from plants through to people. And at one point, as he's getting better and better at it, he sees two people arguing, a man and a woman. And the man is quite bullish. And he says, I could see all the dark energy around the man. It was enveloping the woman. It was sucking all her energy out. And when I read that, I thought, wow, hang on a minute. You know, when you have somebody like that and you talk to them, somebody really negative or somebody really bullish, don't we say they've just sucked the energy out of me? And don't you feel depleted of energy? So in that sense, I do get this whole energy thing. So spirituality is important for me. The quality of my thoughts, the quality of my actions, the quality of my conversations is very important. The other key thing that's really important for me are my values. So I have strong values, and I've taken time out to understand what my values are, because I know now that I don't have to be friends with the whole world. And it's not about connecting with like-minded people anymore. That's what we used to be told. For me, it's about connecting with like-valued people. And when you connect with like-valued people, your relationship is automatically much deeper straight away. So you have a much more valuable relationship. So sort of that's how I see life now. And I live in my own little island here, walking around in the world with these silly little thoughts in my head. And that's how I conduct. You know, I don't like particularly big groups, networking or any of that, but I do love having small groups where I feel safe and having great conversations. I do like that.
Yeah, but Cole, how many people are you hoping to get to your human-centered leadership conference?
About 350, 400.
That really small group.
Yeah, well, you know, David, when we had our last Ignite Your Potential event, our motivational event, we had nearly 400 people there. And there's me dancing on the stage, and I'm getting all the audience dancing. And at one point, I hypnotized the whole audience as well to put them on a mindfulness sort of journey, a guided meditation. I know I can do that stuff now, but I have to put a certain energy into it because it's not my natural type. You know, we were talking about color preferences and, you know, behavioral preferences the other day. So I know I can shift my energy, but what happens is at the end of the day, after all it's said and done, I'm exhausted because I've exerted energy into it. So I know I can do it. And, you know, when you see me at the Human Centered Leadership Conference, you'll probably see that I'm not networking like crazy, like some of these incredible people that I know who can do it. I can't do it. I'm probably going to be the person in the corner having deep one-on-one conversations with one or two individuals. That's what I do.
Yeah, I totally get that. I mean, the weekend, you could see it. You know, we were talking about color profiles, Adam, guys. I don't know if you're familiar with the color profiles. Cole, no. a quick overview of the color profiles and personalities.
Like Myers-Briggs, Belbin, colors profiles, DISC profiles. So basically, every one of us will have natural states that we prefer. We might be more introverted, more extroverted. We might be more about logic. We might be more about intuition and people. Whatever our natural state is, when we're in the natural state, that's when we perform at our very best. And when we come into contact with somebody else who has a completely different natural state and natural behavioral preference, sometimes we can rub up against each other. And if we don't think it through, we can easily fall out or say, I'm not going to talk to that person, or I'm not going to work with them. But actually, if you give it some thought and just realize that it's not that they're a bad person or that they don't like it, it's just that they're coming from a different place. And it's diversity at its very essence, it's diversity. So, I mean, you've just made me think about diversity. I think we've got diversity all wrong. I think, you know, all this nonsense that we talk about with equity, diversity and inclusion, it's all wrong. And I've been involved in the whole area of diversity for best part of 40 years because I was, you know, such a minority in the police service. I was trying to push for diversity all these years. And, you know, I kept saying, like we very often hear, you've got to have representation. You've got to have 3% of BAME in your organization. I now recognize that's not the answer. You know, you can have whatever percentage of whatever you want in your organization, but if they all think the same, if they've all been to similar schools, if they all eat the same food, if they all think in the same way, that's not diversity. It's not going to change your organization. What's going to change your organization is culture transformation, where you create a culture where you welcome people coming with differences of thoughts, differences of opinions, sitting around your boardroom table or your decision-making tables and offering up different opinions and different thoughts, getting rid of your groupthink mentality, your echo chambers that exist. That's true diversity. And inclusion is all about creating the culture where that is allowed to flourish. So when we talk about diversity, I think we get it all wrong. And that's why we don't seem to make any headway on diversity. We just need to stop being so nonsensical about it. We need to be brave enough to have the difficult conversations. And we can do this. We can fix this. If you look at what this country is made up of now, this country is a beautifully diverse country. You know, our bloody favorite food is curry, for goodness sakes. And it's not even the curry from India. It's a curry that we've made up in this country. So it's unique to the UK. We need to understand all of that and understand the rich mix of people that we've got, but then understand below all of that, every single person thinks differently, behaves differently, has different experiences, therefore will have different thoughts. I get really frustrated when I see these like 9 protected characteristics, all women should be in this characteristic, all black people in this characteristic, all gay people. That's so stupid, because gay people don't all think the same. Black people don't all think the same. Women don't all think the same, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Everybody thinks differently. Sorry about that, David. You just got
no. One. EDI was on my list, and I thought I was going to save it because I knew you'd like that one and get you going. While you're on EDI, why don't you just give us your view on what people keep labeling as soft skills in the workplace? I know you love things like empathy being called soft skills.
You know, I've heard this so many times that, and I hear it less and less, thankfully. You know, hard skills are the technical skills that you learn as a leader. So whatever your organization is, for me, it was pleasing. So the hard skills were, you've got to learn your law, you've got to learn the procedure, you've got to learn the command structure, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The soft skills, which then suggest they're nice to have skills, the soft skills are your ability to communicate with other people, your ability to build relationships, your ability to empathize with other people, your ability to work as part of a team. That's nonsense. Because you could have all the technical skills in the world. I don't care. You could have a group full of first degree people in your team. But if they don't get on, if they don't talk to each other, if there's no trust between them, if there's no relationships between them, do you really think that they're going to outperform? No, they're not. For me, I work with organizations and I say, when you go through your recruitment process, make sure that you build values right at the very heart of your computer, your recruitment process. So you're testing people on their values. But in order for you to do that, make sure you know what your organizational values are. Make sure they're just not pretty words on a pretty poster. Make sure they're meaningful. Make sure you really thought them through and make sure that everybody's signed up to them, and then recruit based on those values. And you'll find that you'll get a much better caliber of person. Yeah. You know, can you imagine if you've got an organization where everybody believes in these values? It's going to be a much more vibrant organization.
Yeah, and I think you know, one of the first things I realized is when I became the CEO is you know, it's very hard to come up with values in the sense of just words. And we did have a poster, and after about 3 months, I don't know what they are. I don't really know what they mean. They were just words. Hmm. And I think the culture you create becomes the values. I mean,
yeah, absolutely.
It's very hard to distill it into words. It's something you need to live and breathe and be in, and that is your values. Because it's no point saying you want to be honest, you know, because who doesn't?
What does that mean?
Yeah,
I mean, I do this work with organizations, with executive teams, where I sit down and get them to really think deep to the point that they're almost sweating, to really think deep about the values, and then to add some meaning to the values. So if they do say, right, our value is honesty, I say, well, give me a sentence and explain that to me. What does that mean? If I were to put a sentence under that word honesty, what would it be? And you have to be prepared to put that on your poster. It's that kind of stuff for me. Really understand your mission. Understand where it is that you want to get to. Understand what your values are, because your values are going to underpin that. But then you have to have a foundation to your building, and that foundation has got to be trust. So how do you build trust in your organization? You have to have real conversations. You have to have authentic conversations. You have to have vulnerability at the heart of everything that you do. And you have to have human-centered leadership.
Absolutely. Nicely ended on that sentence. The values I try to impinge, that's not the right word. When I tried to think of how we could put it into words that meant something, I just got really down to something that's quite simple. I don't know if it's too simple, but essentially I just said, look, all of us, if we are just always looking to be useful and be kind, and I think
great.
If we apply that to any situation, I look through our organization. So if you're a customer service person interacting with one of our customers, if everything you do is looking to be useful and looking to be kind, we're going to have really good outcomes. If you're looking to your colleague to your left, you know, they might be struggling, they might be behind on the words. You can be kind, you can make them a cup of tea, you could be useful, you could help them out with their work. And you can kind of apply that to almost any situation, not just in work, but in your own personal life. And they're not these just cliched words, and you can put them into a sentence that actually means something. And if everyone 100%. Did that with every action, then what a great place it would be.
I mean, what I like about that is the simplicity of it as well. Mm. You know, sometimes we think that we have to complicate it.
You know, being kind doesn't cost much, and there was that whole, and it was a bit corny, and there's a film, and okay, so you look at like the pay it forward movement and all of that, and they took that to the nth degree, but the concept of that is absolutely like valid. The concept of that is if you just do one thing for one person that's kind, and then you do, and everybody does that to two people or three people, and then they do it to three people, and then they do it to, and that whole pay it forward movement, and as I say, you know, back in the day the film was a bit corny and a bit cheesy and stuff, but actually the concept is valid. And taking your point, Dave, if you do that one thing for two people or three people, and then each of those people do it for another three people, then actually you create an environment where it's absolutely, the culture is one of support, it's trust, it's respect. And I take your point, Cole, in terms of it's really easy just to write those things down on a piece of paper when you go to your leadership conferences and you go to your networking days and say, oh, well, our culture is this. And we want, yeah, but what does that actually mean? How does that permeate through your organization? If I was to go and speak to Bill the cleaner or Steve the receptionist or whoever it is, what does that mean to them?
Yeah.
From the very, very top level to the very, very bottom level of your organization, what does that mean to each and every one of those people? And if you can get those things permeating through your organization, then you've absolutely hit the golden thread there. Because it's really easy just to put things on paper and it sounds wonderful and it sounds exciting and it's great when you're networking. Oh, we have this and we have this. Okay. But then when you're challenging, I think challenge is another really important key thing within your organization. You have to have the ability to challenge people
100%.
And then accept challenge from other people.
Yep.
And if you can challenge people and accept challenge and then find a way of them moving forward, I think that's really important as well. But I think how those key phrases, respect and trust and empathy and all of that, how do they permeate through your organization? That's the key bit for me. That's the crux of a super, super, super strong culture. It is what does that look like to each of your employees?
I think you're absolutely right. I think a lot of organizations have these things in place, but they're treated more like a safety blanket or a tick in the box, and so it's not really lived out. And I think your point around you've got to have an environment where you can challenge, I think absolutely right. I work with a lot of executive teams, and I often look to a book written by a chap called Patrick Lencioni, and it's called The Five Dysfunctions of a Team, and it's specifically around executive leadership teams, but it actually can apply to an organization. And he says, look, the five dysfunctions of a team tend to be this pyramid. And he says, at the bottom of the pyramid, he says, lack of trust. He says, you have a lack of trust where people don't have real relationships with each other. They're not vulnerable with each other. They don't know each other as human beings. They only see each other as colleagues or peers. You have to go way beyond that. And particularly in an executive team, you have to get close because you tend to be a small in number. And if you don't have trust in your team, then you're not going to have conflict. And he says, you have to have conflict. You have to have healthy conflict in any good team. So an example of healthy conflict would be when you sit around the meeting table and somebody has an opposing view. If they are more extroverted than you or louder than you, or maybe you're the only person that's got a contrary view, do you voice your view? Or do you just sit there simmering in bubbling in anger and frustration? So consequently, when the decision is made, somebody says to you, how was that meeting? You say, oh, it was a crap meeting. So he says the next level then is commitment. So if you don't really, if you've not had the healthy conflict, nobody's going to be truly committed to the decision that's made. So consequently, all of you will sort of play at it, but you won't do it to its full degree. And if you don't do it to its full degree, the fourth element is accountability. You're going to be frightened to hold each other to account. A, you don't trust each other anyway. And B, because you're not doing what you're supposed to be doing, you don't want to hold somebody else to account just in case a finger comes back to you. And it says, and finally, what happens, the fifth element is, as a result of that, is that you end up either going off in different directions with silo mentality, or you just don't go in the direction that you're pointing at in the first place. So it's a bit like getting into a ship in Liverpool Harbour, setting sail for New York, but going off one degree and ending up in, I don't know, Boston or somewhere like that. So it's a bit like that, he says. So I think you're absolutely right around challenge. You've got to have healthy conflict in any organization, but to have it, you have to have trust.
Yeah, absolutely.
Indeed, indeed. Well, we normally wrap these things up around about the hour mark. So has anybody got any final questions for Cole before we let him go?
Well, I'm just going to tee Cole up, really, just to just remind us when the Human Centered Leadership Conference is and where people can find out more about it.
Yeah, so the Human Centered Leadership Conference, I think it's going to be a landmark conference. It's the first time that senior leaders from all industries are going to get together to talk about what does a workplace culture look like now. COVID changed the way that we think, the way that we do business. So organizations have to shape up to this new world, and the workplace has changed. So that's what the conference is all about. So you can find out more about it on www.humancenteredleadership.co.uk. And I look forward to seeing you there.
Indeed. And I will stick that link in our blog. We always do a little blog about every single episode that we have it on. So I'll stick it on the website so people can click on it and hopefully take a look at that. Gaz, have you got any final questions?
No final questions, but found Cole absolutely fascinating, insightful. Love listening to the journey he's been on, just from, you know, from a very personal point of view, just in my line of work, I'm already starting to think, you know, some of the things that he's mentioned, how does that relate to me and my role, and how does that relate in my organization? And I'll definitely be thinking about whether we can invest in that. And I'll chat to you probably at some point, Cole, about what we can do, just in terms of whether it just be our management or whether it be our parent company's management. And that's so what we can do, because a lot of the work that we try to do is around sort of valuing and adding value to staff and how you enrich your whole culture of your environment and all of that. So, yeah, fascinating, absolutely fascinating. So, yeah, I loved it.
Brilliant. Thank you.
Indeed, indeed. Yeah, I would, you know, I'll say on behalf of these guys as well, thank you very much for giving up an hour of your time. Like we said at the start, it might be one of those things where you change your policy upon saying yes to everything coming on Tallboy Radio.
You know what? Can I be honest? I've thoroughly enjoyed it. I was in stitches at the start, but we've had a great conversation.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I even managed to resist telling a little bit of a joke about your brother, who is the lawyer and the doctor, and something about trying his patients and stuff like that. I've waited an hour, but I've got it in.
We needed a dad joke. There it is.
Always finish on a dad joke. So, Cole, if you'd like to say your goodbyes to our listeners.
Thank you so much. Thanks for listening. I've enjoyed your company, and really thank you for asking me to come on here. It's one of the best I've done, I'll be honest with you.
Well, there you go. There you go. We'll put that on our slogan. Dave?
Yeah, we just edit it as well. So we just edit it slightly just to the best I've done. I think that's brilliant. Thanks, Cole. I really appreciate you taking the time, Cole. It's been great having you on the podcast. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Yeah, 100%. Gazza?
So thanks a few minutes ago. Appreciate your time. Fascinating to listen to your talk. So thoroughly enjoyed it. And fingers crossed you'd be up for coming on again at some point and carrying on the conversation. It'd be brilliant.
Definitely. I'll get a non-alcoholic beer with me next time. Because we didn't talk about me packing up drinking. Oh, yeah, nice. I packed up drinking, smoking, eating meat, fish, eggs, all on the same day 20 years ago. And then, I'm in good company.
I won't show you mine.
I packed up tea and coffee 8 years ago and fruit juices and pop. And then 6 years ago, gave up drinking milk. And then wrote a book about it.
When's the biscuits going, Cole?
Oh, I don't know about that. That's the tough one. Biscuits and chocolate, that's the hard one.
Tell me about it. And beer for me as well. But that's, in fact, you just named all of my vices and then there's some more. Well, no, thank you very much for joining us. We've really appreciated it. I hope our listeners take something out of it, whether they are the CEO of a business or somebody who just wants to make a little bit of a difference in their life, whether that be at work or their personal life. I think there's a little bit of something there for everyone. So I've really appreciated you being on here. We'll look forward to having you on again, hearing about your writing books, because we've had this before in terms of authorism and how we aren't capable. We wanted more people who are. That's one for another day. But I'd like to hear more about it. Not so much about the giving up of alcohol, but I'd be intrigued as to how you manage that one. But that is us for this week, and we'll catch you again next week when we'll be talking about something entirely different altogether.